Welcome, welcome, everybody, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast brought to you by thehockeythinktank.com, a website for all your hockey needs. If you want a little bit of education, a little bit of inspiration, want to be a little bit better as a player, as a coach, or even a parent, I think you'll love the website. Again, we can't express enough how appreciative we are for all of the support and the reception that we've gotten from the site, from the amount of people that have subscribed to the amount of people that have given us positive feedback. We absolutely love bringing a lot of content to the hockey world. So thank you, everybody, for everything you've done for our site. And today we have a really, really special guest, especially for me. We have Enrico Blasi, who is the head coach at Miami of Ohio. He's been the head coach there since 1999. He's a five-time CCHA Coach of the Year. He's a Spencer Penrose Award winner, which goes to the top coach in college hockey. He's the guy that built the brotherhood that everybody knows and is so fond of nowadays. So Enrico was actually the guy that gave me my first coaching gig as a volunteer assistant, as a graduate assistant back in 2011. So I'll be forever grateful for him giving me my start into coaching. And before we get to Rico, though, I want to introduce my partner, my cousin, in this fun little venture, Jeff LaVecchio. Jeff, how are we doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Pretty embarrassed that I missed this call with Rico. It was one I was definitely looking forward to because we got knocked out at Western Michigan by him and his team at Miami of Ohio when I was playing college hockey. So I really wanted to ask him a couple questions that pertain to that time, but unfortunately I was stuck in the gym doing calf raises all day trying to make these little getaway sticks grow. So I wasn't able to be on the call, but I listened to it after you talked to him. And what an interesting human being, interesting guy. Very cool how he got his start so young as a college hockey coach. And you know, just had a lot of cool things about the brotherhood and George Gwozdecki, who we've also had on the podcast, and kind of tied everything together nicely with you and Gwozdecki and that whole connection.
Yeah, it was a blast when I got to coach at Miami. It was my first experience as a coach, and just a learning experience that I had. And we had a great staff. Brent Brecky, who I actually played for at Cornell, who moved on to Miami and now is an assistant coach at Clarkson. Nick Petraglia, you know, those two guys are still one of my best friends today. And we just had a lot of fun. It wasn't always easy, but it's really cool to get behind the curtain and see, you know, as players, sometimes we think that the coaches just kind of sit around and drink coffee and watch video and just talk hockey all day. But there's so much more to it than that. And those guys were great examples for me getting in. And, you know, I thought it was especially the story that Coach talked about when we played at Michigan State and the team wasn't doing very well. So we had to make some drastic changes and really hold some kids accountable and ended up changing our season. That was a great story. And I think another thing for anybody that aspires to be a coach, you know, you never know when your opportunity is going to come. And Rico talked a lot about how, you know, he was living at home in Toronto. And then because of his relationship with George Gwozdecki, he ended up as a volunteer at Denver. And then he just knocked in and knocked and knocked on the door and said, "Hey, I want to be promoted. I want this job." And then Miami came open, the head coaching position. And it wasn't easy for him to get that. And he got looked over and passed over, but he kept, you know, putting his name in there and he kept being resilient. And obviously 20 years later, he's done an unbelievable job with the program. So there's a lot of lessons, I think, in this conversation for a lot of young coaches that want to get into the business. And I think people are really going to enjoy it. That's for sure.
Is he, do you know what the youngest ever Division I college hockey coach was? Like, I mean, he was pretty young. I mean, he's got to be up there, right?
I would imagine so. I mean, dating back, I mean, that age now is pretty unheard of. I think you really have to, there's so many people that want to get into it now, and college hockey is a lot bigger now than it was back then. So I don't know if that's even possible today, but he had to have been the youngest coach in college hockey when he took over. I don't know about ever or in the history, but he certainly at 27 years old, that's young. That's very, very young.
Yeah, I can't, like, I mean, I was only maybe in my fourth year pro by then or something. I can never imagine coaching a Division I college hockey program. And I don't know the state of Miami's hockey team when he took over, but I know that when we played them, they were an absolute powerhouse. I mean, they were always good, always one of the best teams, always the one of the best rinks to play at, best atmosphere. I mean, that was just an unbelievable program to play against. So pretty intense and crazy that someone at 27 took that program to where he got it to.
Yeah, for sure. And it was fun to hear some of the stories of the ups and the downs along the way, because building a program like that, you know, it doesn't come without your lumps. And, you know, but he was a great coach. He's an even better person. And it was really interesting to get to sit and chat with him, especially a few years after working together. So without further ado, let's actually bring it over to Rico. So welcome to the show, Coach Blasey, the head coach at Miami of Ohio Hockey since 1999. And Coach Blasey was the first person to let me onto his coaching staff. So very, very appreciative, not only for him being on the podcast here today, but also for letting me get my start in my coaching career. So Coach Blasey, how's it going out there in Oxford, Ohio?
Going well, Toph. Quite some time ago when you stood beside me on the bench. So it was a fun year. It was exciting to win the CCHA playoff championship with you on staff.
Yeah, that was definitely a fun year, and definitely want to talk a lot about that year a little bit later. But first, wanted to just get a little bit of a sense of Coach Blasey growing up. You grew up right outside of Toronto, a hockey hotbed. Talk to me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Toronto in the Blasey household.
well, that's a lot there, but. You know, I was first generation Italian, so my parents spoke very little English, and you know, they were two hardworking, to this day still hardworking people, and kind of had to fight their way around and navigate their way around a different country and try to raise a family. And you know, for us, we were always focused on trying to be good people and, you know, be very faithful in our religion and Catholic faith, and really just try to appreciate everything that we had and work hard. And, we were fortunate enough to have some friends that were playing hockey at the time. And, you know, my dad was a little reluctant at first, but, once we started playing and, he got the bug of, watching his kids play a sport, we just kind of took off from there. And you know, both mom and dad were very supportive of us playing hockey, my brother and I, and you know, it's just something that we love to do.
That's awesome. And let's say we could call you a quasi-competitive person. So is that something that, you know, growing up with a brother, did you guys compete with each other a lot? What was that like?
We did compete. I mean, I think it was always really kind of friendly competition. He was 2 years younger, but I think the competitive edge comes from just knowing that we had to fight for everything. You know, me being of small stature, you would appreciate this. you know, along the way, we had a lot of coaches tell me, my dad, that I would never play at a high level because I was too small. And, you know, I think that kind of motivated me and made me even want it more. And so that competitiveness and that drive and that determination, I think, started to kind of shape as we went through the early stages of our of my life anyway, and certainly my hockey career. So, I think that's been built on over years, and you know, I think it's still there.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, and the joke was when I was coaching on your staff that the only reason why you hired me is so you can look tall on the bench. So that's I love it.
Well, and do you want me to tell that story? We're playing at Bowling Green. You were standing beside me, if you remember.
I do. Yeah.
I got a text from a former teammate of mine, an alum, that said, "I understand now why you hired Topher, because you're a little bit taller than he is." So But not by much, right, Toby?
maybe if I have skates on, yeah, that will be a little bit closer. But no, that was so much fun, and the friendly banter going on in that coach's room between you and Brex and Trags and I and a couple other guys. I had a ton of fun that year, and I'll forever be grateful to you and especially Brex, who I played for at Cornell, for letting me get my start with my coaching career at Miami. But you know, for you, it was a little bit similar to the way that I started coaching too. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you played for George Gwozdecki at Miami of Ohio, and then you got your starting career as an assistant coach at Denver when he was out there at Denver. What was that process like getting into coaching, and what was it like to coach with the person that you played for in college?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a kind of windy road a little bit for me. You know, when I graduated from Miami, I decided to, you know, I had an opportunity to go play in Italy, obviously with an Italian family and passport. That was an opportunity that was presented to me, and I decided to stay in North America and try my hand in playing a little pro hockey here in the U.S. And that year, the East Coast League, for whatever reason, wasn't a good fit for me. And after about a week and a half of being in the league, I decided to go home and just get on with my life, and was fortunate enough to get a job with my uncle, who was a president of a lighting service company. And then I was able to hook on with the junior team that I played for in Toronto, the Wexford Raiders. And so I was an assistant coach there for the junior team for pretty much the entire season. And I helped guys just try to navigate through their studies and, you know, how to talk to college coaches and what the experience was like for me as a college player. So we had about 12 guys get scholarships that year from that junior team.
Wow.
You know, and Coach Gwozdecki was really upfront with me when I graduated, and he went to Denver at that summer that, you know, we had a conversation before he left, and he asked me at that point, you know, did I ever think about maybe getting into coaching? And I said, at this point, I didn't think I would want to do that, and I want to pursue a career in playing still. And but once that door was closed and I got the coaching bug with the young guys in Toronto, Coach was recruiting a young man by the name of Gavin Morgan, who's an assistant at Alabama Huntsville now.
Yeah.
And he was our captain on that junior team. And so Coach came in to watch him play, and we went to lunch, and I don't know exactly how the conversation went, but I went home and told my mom I was going to be a graduate assistant at the University of Denver in the fall, and I thought she was going to kill me. having been away from home for the last 4 years, she thought she had her son back, but I just trusted Coach's, you know, everything that he was doing at Denver and the way he did it with us at Miami. And I thought I wanted to be a part of it and learn the business from him. And so I packed a bag and had no car, no money, and just went to Denver and trusted that he would take care of me. And so that's how I got to Denver. And, you know, I was the volunteer. I took some graduate work. I did whatever Coach wanted me to do that first year. I work with the goalies. I had no idea what to do with goalies, but I would meet with anybody that had any goalie experience. In particular, Ron Graham, who's associate AD at the University of Denver and played in the NHL, played at Denver. And so I would go to him and just ask his advice. What do I do? How do I set up these drills? And so he would share his thoughts with me. And I helped out in the strength and conditioning program that first year. And you know, I live with Steve Miller, who's assistant at Ohio State and happened to be an assistant for us at Miami, and learned a lot from Steve Miller and Coach Gwozdecki that year. And that summer, Greg Drexel, who was the assistant with them at the time and with us at the time at Denver, decided to take on a job in the NHL as a head scout for the LA Kings. And I was naive enough, Toph, to walk in the coach's office that May and say I want, and say to him that I wanted the job. And he kind of looked at me and started laughing the first time. I'm like, I really want this job. And he said, well, we're gonna interview, and you know, I'll let you know if you're gonna be part of the interview. And let's just say the next month was difficult. I watched guys come in and out and interview the job, and I wasn't one of them. So, but you know, a month went by, a month and a half went by, and coach hadn't hired anybody yet. And I'm thinking, okay, I had no idea what was going on, and I had committed to coming back and finishing my master's degree and being with the team. So that was the plan. I got a call. Gosh, it must have been July, from coach saying that, he decided to give me an opportunity to be an assistant coach, and I never did interview. I think he believed in what I was doing, and the rest, I guess, is history. 3 years later, got the job at Miami, and, you know, I owe a lot to Coach Gwozdecki, obviously, as a player, and, more importantly, as a coach, and teaching me the ropes, along with Steve Miller. I think Steve deserves a lot of credit as well, just in the recruiting and just, you know, how to go about doing that. So I learned a lot. It was different than being a player. As you know, you played for Coach Schaaf, and, you know, as a player, I was terrified of Coach at times, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm working alongside him. So it took me a little while to get comfortable and voicing my opinion, but, you know, Coach Gwozdecki was one guy that he didn't care if you were a GA or a volunteer or, you know, the equipment manager or the trainer. He wanted your opinion so that he could, you know, do what's best for the program and the players.
That's awesome. And is that something that you took with you as a coach when you became a head coach? Because I was shocked when I got to start coaching with you guys at Miami. I couldn't believe the amount of responsibility that you gave me, even from the start, in terms of, you know, working with the players, and then, you know, a little bit later doing video and pre-scouts and stuff like that. I always thought it was, you know, pretty awesome, especially as a young coach, you know, how much responsibility you gave and how much trust you put in me right from the start. Is that something that, you know, you kind of learned from coach at Denver? You know, you've obviously hired a lot of really good assistant coach in the past, guys like Jeff Blashill and Chris Bergeron and Brent Brecky and Nick Petraglia. And now you have Peter Menino and Joel Beal, who are great up and coming coaches too. Talk to me a little bit about just your coaching philosophy when it comes to that and empowering your assistant coaches that you have with you.
Well, I absolutely learned that from George, and I think what I experienced through what he gave me right off the bat as basically a you know, rookie coach and trusting me with a lot. You know, I think that the most important thing is, though, is, you know, I wanted to make sure that if you were on our staff, you could back up your ideas, and if you could sell me, then you can sell anybody. And if your idea was something that, you know, the staff felt that it was a good thing for our program and our players, then we wanted to hear about it. So, you know, your experiences as a player were different than my experiences or somebody else's experience. And it doesn't make it right or wrong, but it could help even 1%. So to me, it's important if you're going to be a staff and you're going to preach the team game and you're going to call yourself a family like we do here at Miami, that it's important that everybody feels that ownership. And I think that's really the only way to do it. I know, and you can speak probably better, we probably had a lot of arguments about what we were going to do in certain times of that year. But I think that's healthy too. And when we left the office, we were always on the same page, and I think our players appreciated that and appreciated the fact that we were working just as hard as they were to make our team better.
Yeah, for sure. No, there's certainly a lot of different opinions, and the learning experience that I got just from being around that coaching room was invaluable. And, you know, just kind of segueing that, you talk about learning experiences. You became a head coach. What were you, 27, 28 years old when you became a head coach at Miami?
Yeah, 27. So you're dating me now.
Right? So you became a head coach of an NCAA Division I school at 27 years old. What the heck was that like? And you've obviously built Miami into a national powerhouse in the years after, but what was going through your head as that young of a coach taking on not just any program, but your alma mater back in the late 90s?
Well, you know, I was really happy at Denver. We had a really good team. We were coming off the WCHA playoff championship in 99, and we were starting to really kind of turn the corner to making it a national champion. And obviously years later it happened with Denver. And so I had really no idea that this would even happen. So I was happy. We were just met my wife, my future wife, and things were going really well. And then Mark Mangiolini, who was the head coach here at Miami, decided to leave for Harvard. And
bad choice, and then, Harvard. Ugh, gross.
Well, coming from a good Cornell guy, I walked in the coach's office again, just like I did the 3 years earlier, and I said, "Coach, what do you think? The Miami job's open, and I think I'm going to put my name in." He goes, "Okay." He said, "I think," he said, "well, the experience of interviewing might be good for you down the road." And I thought that, I actually thought the same thing. I said, I hadn't really never interviewed anywhere, and it would be good to kind of, you know, just go through the process. And fortunate enough for me, Toph, the AD at Miami at the time, was our AD at the University of Denver for my first 2 years. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
I had a good idea of you know, what he was all about and how he wanted to run the athletic department. So, needless to say, I got a phone interview. I walked in the coach's office again. I said, "Well, I won't be getting another interview, that's for sure, because I think I bombed it." And sure enough, kind of the same thing, Toph. I don't know. Sometimes things happen the way they do, and for the next 2 months, I watched Miami interview current head coaches and, you know, some established assistant coaches, and rightly so. That's what they should have done. And as an alum, that was probably the right thing to do for the program. We needed to have somebody established. And 2 months had gone by, and I got a call in early August from Mr. Maturi saying, we've offered the job to a few guys. They've turned it down, and now we've opened the search up again. So I'm thinking, okay, but we're bringing in, I think he said, five guys, and you're one of the five. I'm like, all right, this is kind of the alumni token, you know, to show the alums that they're interviewing one of their own. So I'm sure I said, sure, I'll come in. And came in on a Saturday morning, left on a Saturday afternoon, late Saturday evening. Had a couple of interviews on campus, and then flew home. And 2 days later, Mr. Maturi called and said, "How would you like to be the next head coach at Miami?" I was like, "You got to be kidding me, right?" And he said, "No, but I need you here tomorrow for the press conference because school starts next week."
Oh, jeez.
I was like, so I didn't really hesitate. I said yes. I called George. He already knew. I guess Mr. Maturi had called him earlier. And, you know, at that point, there was really no time to really think about anything. I remember sitting down with George, and he just said, "Rico, just be who you are, and, you know, I'll be here if you need me." And so those first few months, probably, well, still, Coach Gwazdecki's on speed dial anytime I need him. But I just didn't know what I didn't know. I came in. I had an idea of what we wanted to do, of what we wanted to establish, and you know, we just went to work. And you know, I was fortunate enough to hire some good assistants, and Jeff Blashill and Chris Bergeron, who you mentioned. I had some really good volunteers and graduate assistants like Will Nickel and Barry Schutte in the early years, and those guys really helped us build the program, and we did it together. There were a lot of long nights. There were a lot of losses. There were a lot of questioning. I'm sure the community didn't know what the hell a 27-year-old was doing. But we did it together, and I wouldn't change those days for anything in the world. We learned a lot about, you know, ourselves and coaching, and I'm extremely proud of Coach Bergeron and what he's doing at Bowling Green, and extremely proud of Jeff Blashill and what he's doing with the Red Wings and as an NHL head coach. So we did it all together. We bounced ideas off each other. We yelled at each other. We loved each other. We cried. We laughed. We made mistakes. We won championships. And along the way, we somehow developed this brotherhood mantra and, you know, defined it. We had a lot of help from a guy by the name of Don DiPaolo, who was our leadership consultant.
Yep.
And worked with us for free. And a lot of good players. We took some chances on players, but they paid it back in the way they played and the way they developed. And, you know, I just, so we got lucky, Toph. I don't know what else to say. It doesn't happen that way. I feel very fortunate that it did happen that way. And, you know, I guess my parents always taught me that when you have an opportunity, make the most of it and make sure you're doing what you need to be doing. And we tried to do that. I tried to do that. And, you know, 20 years later, we're still sitting here.
That's awesome. And, you know, you mentioned the brotherhood, which is synonymous with Miami hockey. And, you know, whenever anybody thinks about Miami hockey, the brotherhood always comes to mind. And talk to me a little bit about what that means. And every time I hear a Miami hockey player win an award or a Miami hockey player talk about Miami hockey, the brotherhood always comes up. Just the culture that you guys have built is second to none. So talk to me a little bit about the brotherhood and what it means to you.
Well, to me, it started when we played for George here in the early 90s. You know, back then it was very unheard of to have sports psychologists come in and talk to the team. And we had that. We created some sort of a mantra for that year, 92-93. And part of that mantra was the phrase, the brotherhood, or really there was no real meaning behind it other than that we were a close team and we were a family and we needed to stick together. And whenever things started to get bad in the locker room or on the ice, we would just remind ourselves that we're the brotherhood. And so that kind of stuck with me through my days at Denver. And we never really brought it to Denver. We thought it was still a Miami thing. And it was important to George and myself and to Steve Miller to just leave it at Miami. But we focused on the same principles at Denver. And we tried to create, you know, the same type of culture at Denver. And I thought we did that. And so for me, it was really the only way to do it was to create a brand, create a culture that was going to be successful over a long period of time, not just a short period of time. I remember the late Ron Mason always said there's a difference between coaching a team and running a program. And I took that to heart. A lot of it from what George taught me, and George happened to be an assistant coach for Ron Mason. So a lot of the things that we were doing were from that kind of coaching tree. And it's just a way of life. It's nothing really earth shattering. It's just good values. It's holding guys accountable, making sure that your behavior and your choices on a daily basis are always with the program in mind and in a good way. And understanding that guys make mistakes and you have to, you know, forgive and move on. You know, the team dynamics are really important to the success of any program. So all those things come into play, and, you know, just basically loving each other, which is kind of something a lot of coaches don't talk about in the locker room. And for me, coming from an Italian household, it was an easy thing to talk about because we did that all the time. And hugging someone wasn't something that was foreign to me. That's how we do things in the Italian world. And you know, you see somebody for the first time or you see somebody for the 150th time, you're still giving them the same hug. So, and it just built from there. The guys defined it. We had a strategic plan. Brad Bates, our athletic director after Mr. Maturi, was one that really challenged us to come up with a strategic plan for our program, to think at 20,000 feet, not at ground level. And it took some time for that to come to fruition. But again, the mentors and the people that challenged us along the way were really influential in our program's success and the building of the brotherhood and the culture.
That's awesome. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be a part of that culture and that brotherhood for a year. You mentioned 2011, we won the first Mason Cup. I believe it was the last year of the CCHA. So it was the last CCHA title ever won. And that was really cool. I grew up a Red Wings fan, so winning at Joe Louis Arena was a huge thrill for me. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that year because I had a blast. We had a blast as a coaching staff. I think the players had a blast. I mean, we had so much fun. There were obviously some good times and some tough times too. But does that team for you stick out a little bit in terms of all the teams that you've coached throughout the years? And talk to me a little bit about that team and maybe some of those players in that team and your experience, because, I mean, I had such a great time that year.
Well, you know, it would be wrong for me to say that that team sticks out any more than any other team, because every team sticks out for me in certain ways, good or bad. And but that team had a group of seniors that had been to two Frozen Fours, had lost in that national championship game in overtime. And
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Yeah, I'll bring it up because that group is really a special group in terms of what they went through and how much they accomplished. And I think that championship, TOEFL, really is kind of the forgotten championship because of what had happened the 2 years previous to that, won the national championship game. But then the year after that, we went back to Frozen Four and lost in the semis. And so here we are with a really good team, and we had our ups and downs, if you remember. We had a stretch right after Christmas where we weren't winning games and the guys look very, I would say, exhausted, yep. Probably disinterested, if that's a good word. And if you remember, we had a real big debate at Ohio State the week before we went to Michigan State. And then we went to Michigan State and laid a big egg on the Friday night. And I remember sitting in the hotel room and we talked as a staff, we have to do something drastic. We can't be going down this road here. We got too much hockey left and we're a really good team. And how are we going to change this and turn it? And this is the moment, I think the defining moment of that season. We decided to sit five players and play three lines in 5D. And I remember going out for warm up with you. I don't know if you remember this, but the Michigan State team at the time looked over and we had basically half a team out there.
Yeah.
And they were all looking at us warming up. And I think I said it to you, and maybe it was Nick, I can't remember. I said, there's no chance these guys are beating us tonight.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we won 4-0. We didn't lose another game on the way to the CCHA championship. So, Andy Mealy, Carter Camper, Pat Canone, those guys took that team on their shoulders and never looked back.
Yeah, that was, I still remember that moment at Michigan State being up, you know, being up in the stands and watching. You see, we don't even have a full bench and people are coming up and at like, what's going on? And, yeah, we didn't lose a game after that. And I think that's a lesson for all the coaches, you know, in terms of how important accountability is. And it doesn't matter who you are. If you're not doing the things that are going to help our team successful, if you're not being a good teammate, you know, that's one of the things I love to read in John Wooden, and one of his favorite quotes is, my best friend is the bench. And that's the only thing that I control as a coach is ice time. And that's the one thing that players crave. So, that was a huge, huge moment and, something that I'll never forget. But, the feeling that we had as a staff after you decided to make that decision was kind of like, all right, I think this is it. Let's giddy up and let's go. Like, what were your thoughts? Kind of, you mentioned a little bit, like, we're not going to lose this game, but what were your thoughts kind of going through the game and right after, and even reflecting now a bunch of years later, is that a story that you use with your teams now? Is that something that when you talk to younger coaches, you kind of reflect back and talk about?
I don't really talk about it unless I'm asked. But I do remember that afternoon thinking, boy, this could go one of two ways. We can win this thing, or I'm going to look like a complete idiot and I'm going to have to answer a lot of questions back on campus. So if you remember also, we took a lot of grief from some NHL guys because we sat some NHL draft picks and those guys were coming to watch their guys and we didn't care. And so we got a little bit of a stink eye for sure. But you know, it's one of those things that, again, it was the right time. We were all on the same page as a staff. We needed to do it. It was a hard decision. It wasn't an easy decision. Probably a lot easier knowing you had Andy Mealy, who was the Hobey Baker winner that year, and Carter Camper, who had over 200 points in college. And so it wasn't exactly like we were putting out the B team. But,
yeah.
But it was a decision that I think everybody knew, okay, we can't mess around now. We got to bring our A game every day, and coach is not afraid to sit anybody. So everybody's on alert. And I think it helps the culture. And I think the story still, after all these years, is still kind of talked about within our team and our alums. And it just came kind of filters through the classes, because I've heard it over the last couple of years. We all know coaches played with 13 players. Don't mess around. So,
yeah, that's a nice little carrot to dangle.
It's not something I share with anybody unless I'm asked.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Andy Mealy, who won the Hobey Baker that year. And, you know, I coached at the college level for 6 years, and I have to say he's probably my favorite player to coach. I think he's probably cut a little bit out of the same cloth that you and I are. Obviously not a big guy, but, you know, his nickname was the Rat, and just one of the most competitive players I've ever seen. And for me, it was so much fun to coach him, because I don't know if you know this, you probably do, but I legit was late to almost every single one of my classes towards the second half of the year, because I was a graduate assistant and I had a class that was right after practice that I had to go to. But Andy was like, no, you're not going to class, that we're working on stuff. And so I had to spend, you know, an extra 20 to 30 minutes doing some drills with meals after practice. And it was really interesting too, because all of a sudden he started to have all this success. And he was scoring all these points and goals, and he was just playing unbelievable. And all of a sudden, you just saw, even from some of the younger players, like, oh man, maybe I should get into this too. So it started with just me and him, and then it became me and him and maybe one or two other guys. You know, Riley Smith was a big one. Him and Andy played on the same line, and he started coming a little bit. Curtis McKenzie was a younger guy. He was the captain in the AHL Texas team that went to the Calder Cup Finals. And then towards the end of the year, I mean, it was like 10 guys were coming over for the 30 minutes, and Meals was actually starting to get pissed because he wasn't getting the amount of reps that he was used to. But I think that's just encapsulates him as a player and a person. Talk to me a little bit what it was like to coach a guy like Andy.
Well, I think you're talking about a guy that was, one, a competitor, two, was very passionate about what he did, but also a leader, because guys would not go and follow him if he wasn't doing things the right way. And it's not because he all of a sudden became this great player. I mean, he had to work at it. He always had the skill, obviously a smaller player, but he had to work at his game, and he knew that. And everybody else in that locker room really took the cue from Andy, from Pat Cannone, from Vinny Liverdi, from Justin Vive, and from Carter Camper, who are our five seniors, because they were the most professional guys that we had, and they did everything the right way. They would prepare for practice. They would stay late. They would be the first guys on the ice, the last guys off the ice. And when you have leaders like that, it's contagious. And then, you know, you mentioned Riley Smith and Curtis McKenzie. Well, then they took over the next year and they did the same thing. And so to me, that example is just, you can't find it in recruiting. It's almost like you've got to, sometimes you get lucky, but sometimes they have to develop into those leaders. And I think they did that. And those guys had good leaders to learn from. A guy by the name of Ryan Jones was the same way. When Ryan was a senior, those guys were freshmen. So they remember that. And Ryan Jones had a good guy to learn from, and a guy by the name of Andy Green. So we were fortunate enough to have good character players and guys that really loved the game and were passionate. And Andy certainly was one of those guys.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny, you mentioned Vinny Liverdi too. So he's a Chicago guy, so I got a special place for him too. But being a Leafs fan, it was interesting. And I'd love to get your take on this too, because, you know, the Maple Leafs signed him to a one-way NHL deal, pretty much knowing that he wasn't going to play with the Maple Leafs, but he was going to be a staple of their AHL program that was going to filter guys up there. And they signed, the same year, they signed a guy that I played with at Cornell, Colin Greening, to a pretty, I would say, similar situation. You know, I don't think Greener knew or thought he was going to play much in Toronto that year in terms of the NHL club. But those two guys are probably, between the people that I've coached or played with, the most professional, you know, habitual, just do things the right way every day type of players. And I don't think it's any coincidence that, you know, there's so many players playing for the Leafs this year that just were under the tutelage of those two guys last year playing for the Marlies. You know, what would you have to say about that? And you know, what are your thoughts on just how they brought those two guys who are just the ultimate professionals for guys to learn from?
Well, I think it's invaluable. I think it's a smart move by Kyle Dubas and the staff there. And you're talking about two leaders, two winners. How important is that on a young team? I mean, they won the Calder Cup last year, and now they're 7-1 in the NHL, and a lot of those guys played in that Calder Cup team. So to me, it's examples like that of guys like Vinny and that are the real important pieces of your team, because they're not the guys that score all the big goals, and they're not the guys that get all the interviews, but they're the glue of the team. And man, you need those guys to be successful. And certainly Vinny, and I would say Justin Vai for us as well that year. And I think the top three guys got the accolades, and you know, the Campers and the Mealies and the Canonis and the Riley Smiths of the world. But if it weren't for the Vivers and the Verdes, or the McKenzies even, you know, I don't know that we would have had the success we had.
Yeah, for sure. Those guys were awesome. And, you know, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's really important topic to broach here. And, you know, you are on the board of the You Can Play Project, and you had an experience with, you know, a former student manager that passed away in his days at Miami, and his mission has just kind of exploded with the support of the hockey world and his family. You know, talk to me a little bit about the You Can Play Project, how you got involved, just the legacy that Berkey has left within your program. And just, I mean, I got there the year after he passed away, and, you know, he was still a vibrant part of your guys' culture. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about him and just a little bit about you carrying on his legacy, being a part of the You Can Play Project.
Well, I really, you know, Toph, it's very dear to our heart here at Miami, and Brendan was a very special person for us, and just the way he conducted himself as a part of our staff and part of our team and our family. You know, when he decided to tell everybody that he was, gay, was just incredible. The way our team reacted to him as a brother, as a family member, and you know, he was part of our our team no matter what, and guys were very close to him, and the staff was very close to him, and you know, in terms of his legacy and the You Can Play project, Patrick, his brother, and Brian, his dad, and the sisters all deserve all the credit for that. They carried on his mission of making sure that people weren't discriminated against because of their sexuality, and you know, I just support that 100%, and I'm behind the entire project and the family, and as is everybody that's been associated with Miami, and you know, we feel very strongly about that it really doesn't matter. If you can play, you can play, and being a good person, and just treating everybody the same, and it's just the right thing to do. And hopefully with this this push here, and I'm so, every time I get on Twitter and I see a You Can Play game or a parade or anything like that, I just smile, because I know Brendan's looking down and smiling. He had a plan. I'm not sure if this was the plan, but it's pretty darn close.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was, again, I got there the year after he passed away, and it was amazing just the impact that he had on everybody that was there. And obviously he comes from a very highly recognized family in the hockey world, but he did some amazing work with you guys, and it's so cool to see his legacy live on, even though I never met him and don't know him, but just the way that y'all talked about him and the way that the hockey world has gathered and galvanized around his mission for, again, if you can play, you can play, and it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, where you come from, you know, everybody's on equal ground. I think that's such an important message today, so appreciate the fact that you guys are still carrying that message on, and glad that a person that was just seemingly just such a great person, his legacy is living on as well. So we'll continue to get that word out and continue to help encourage people to look into the You Can Play project. But at the end of the day, Coach, this was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and being one of our first guests here for our podcast. I think a lot of people will learn a lot from your story and your advice and just the way that you've lived your life. So thank you so much again for helping me get into the coaching world, but also for sitting here with this podcast with us today. And good luck with the season this season.
Thanks, Toph. You know we love you.
Love you too. Thanks. Bye.
All right.